from Senate Bill 5527, Department of Human Services Office of Medical Assistance Program. And I think everyone is back in here, and we've lost a couple of members, but I'm sure they'll be back. The Senate, the chronologically advanced side is intact.
Yes.
They didn't move.
You're going to miss this next year.
Yeah.
Huh?
You're going to miss this next year.
We can remember where we're
going. No, I asked you about it.
With a little help.
What?
Can't remember the second sale.
Which makes more sense. That's just a flow through here.
What is that about?
Well, from my point of view, we've got a real problem with this kickoff and cutting them back too much. We're closing stuff as well.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, today we start the work session on OMAP, Department of Human Services Office of Medical Assistance Program. As with the other divisions, this is a preliminary work session where we can go so far, and then we'll come back and tie up some outstanding issues in a later work session. What I've handed out is a summary memo, and actually I think you ended up with two of them because I think that Shirley also handed one out. So I don't think you're seeing double. That outlines the overall numbers to date. And then on the back of that, I have a summary spreadsheet that I'll be going through. And then attached to that summary spreadsheet are individual program spreadsheets that show the adjustments that are made to the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid program, the CHIP program, the non-Oregon Health Plan medical programs, and the administration budget. All of those background sheets are the detail by program that add up to the cover sheet. And then after we've gone through that, I've attached a background to the back of that, some of the suggestions that came that come to you as a result of discussions. I can't claim that they all are recommended by every member of the prescription drug work, but they come to you as suggestions that were discussed there. So to begin with, a reminder that the governor's recommended budget for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs is $2.961 billion total funds and 202.03 FTE. This is a 19.8% increase over 9901 estimated expenditures as adjusted for the May rebalance that we just completed a few weeks ago. That is a 1.1% increase when compared to the current service level estimate of $2.927 billion. I've outlined some of the areas, certainly not all, but been reviewing the notes, the highlighted areas that were discussed, particularly the caseload and the fact that the budget is built on a no flexibility caseload assumption. There was a lot of discussion about access to medical services under the plan. There was considerable discussion about the various elements that make up the benefit package, a lot of discussion about prescription drug costs, cost containment options, replacement of the Medicaid Management Information System, which is not in this budget, but which is critical to the operation of OMAP, obviously, and also to its improvement, particularly with relation to its improvement with its experience with providers and the collection of data and analysis of that. And there was discussion about managed care versus fee-for-service costs, and then some discussion about performance measures. And you'll also find on your desk the one-page performance measure report that Senator Yee had asked each agency to provide, and that's available for you. Madam Chair, if you would like, I'll then go to the spreadsheet and go down and show you the detail that how we arrive at these.
I'm just trying to find my one page.
Oh, well, here, I've got... We start on the OMAP total spreadsheet with the governor's printed budget, the 869.9 almost million dollars general fund, and going across the top, there are typical technical rate assessments and reductions for PERS, attorney general rate reduction, and then the telecommunications long distance reduction. What you won't find among those are the audit division and what was the other one? Audit division.
Secretary of State.
Well, that's the
audit division.
That's the audit division. Oh, there was one other mundane one that we've been doing on every budget, but for some reason I can't remember what it is right now.
First. Mundane.
No, they're there. Anyway, the reason that they are not there is because those are taken temporarily in the director's office centralized services program. Ultimately, when we get around to doing the final rebalance, yes, the human resources assessment, that was it. When we get around to doing the final work session, those changes in the central wide services department, the director's office, will be reflected in revised prorates to this Office of Medical Assistance and to the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse, which are all part of the director's office, along with the services, director's office, central services. The next, number five, on line five there is simply a correction. The governor's budget had included some health division pass-through money that should not have been included in the budget, and so that's a technical correction. Getting down into then the reshoot items, there are quite a few adjustments that took place in the reshoot, which is, as you remember, the follow-up to the May rebalance, and how the changes that were approved in the May rebalance affect the 2001-03 budget as they're carried forward. The first of those is a revised Oregon Health Plan caseload forecast, and as was reported during the rebalance time, caseloads in the health plan are going up, and so that is reflected in these general fund and federal fund increases. Offsetting that was a net, when you consider, and here there are lots of variations among the caseloads and cost per case, but offsetting that was a net decrease in fee-for-service cost projection, and it's my understanding that this was based on going out and incorporating a longer view into the forecast. I don't remember what the exact month of the first long view was, but I think this carries the view out to 36 months, and therefore reprojects those costs looking farther back and getting more data upon which to base those, so that eliminated some costs in the projection for fee-for-service rate costs. The Oregon Health Plan Medicaid leveraging adjustments, this is somewhat of a technical adjustment in that it is reflecting revised forecasts for some of the disproportionate share and other Oregon Health Sciences University pass-throughs for Medicaid match. Then there's a hospital. There's an adjustment in revenues from a variety of sources, primarily hospital payments and settlements, but some other miscellaneous revenue adjustments, and that produces the negative, the general fund savings that you see here of $608,061. And later on, I'll be referencing another adjustment to that. to that line as well, because that line included among the miscellaneous revenue adjustments some issues that, an issue that really was not a current service level issue and should not have been included in there. And so I will propose an adjustment to that a little later. The next line is a revised Oregon Health Plan other funds revenue estimate. That's simply taking all of the other funds revenue estimates based on the May for rebalance, and that generated some additional revenue from other funds and therefore a reduction in general fund. The same with revised tobacco tax revenue forecast. That is based on higher, it's my understanding, higher tobacco tax revenue in the current biennium than was anticipated, and therefore some carryover of tobacco tax revenue. You'll remember that tobacco tax revenue forecast for 2001-03 is actually down some from what, almost $2 million from what's in the governor's budget, but partially mitigating some of the increased costs is additional tobacco tax revenue that can be carried over to the next biennium.
Madam Chair,
Senator, yes.
This committee has asked for the amount of tobacco tax, tobacco litigation and settlement money, how much for 2001-03 and how much money has been designated to be used and what is remaining. I have not received a list yet. Has the other committee members received a list?
You have not.
Okay, Madam Chair, that's my fault because I'm the one who said that I would distribute that list.
I don't mean to.
No, that's okay. It's three. I can tell you what it is, but you probably want to have it in writing.
Yes, but you can tell us what it is now.
Okay, it's $348 million. Let me count this as we go. It's $7 million in tobacco cessation in the health division. That's in the governor's budget. It is $100 million in a trust, $101 million in ending balance, $110 million in K through 12, and that's, I'm $20 million short.
You're $13 million short.
FIA.
Yes, thank you. $22 million in FIA.
Well, you have $8 million left. That's $349 million.
The difference.
It's
349, right?
Should be
7 1 3 7 101 110 and 22. So those are the four. Whatever that comes out to.
340.
Yeah. Well, there's some minor difference there, so. I'll get you the written.
The station was 7, you said.
The station is 7. The trust fund was $100 million. The ending balance may have been 110. No, the 110 million was in education. Ending balance 101 million, and FIOP 22 million.
Well, it was $8 million.
Yeah. So I'll get you the list. Yes. But I can't think of any other than those. But there's nothing in at this time in the Oregon Health Plan related to that.
Mm-hmm. So if we can have a list so we know how much money maybe we can spend.
It's all spent.
Uh-huh. Nothing.
No, that's all. That spends all of it.
Oh,
yeah. let me see. Fully qualified, federally qualified, I think it is, health centers, reimbursement at full cost. This is a recent balanced budget decision that requires full cost reimbursement for the federally qualified health centers, and so this was not in the governor's budget, and so that rate increase has to be reflected in the...
That's new.
These are all reshoot issues that reflect the changes that took place in the rebalance. And there was a federal funds limitation correction. That was a correction in the reshoot, simply an error in the budget, in the original budget. And there is the federal Medicaid match that goes from 59.5 to 59.34% of the larger amount was built into the governor's budget, and therefore, since the rate is going down, you have to backfill the general fund. And there is the Attorney General opinion that came out after the session began that said that the Motor Vehicle Accident Fund could not be used for the purposes for which it was being used in the health plan. And so, again, that requires that the other fund's revenue coming from that fund be backfilled with general fund. And then getting into the CHIP program, this reflects the May forecast, the May rebalance forecast adjustment for the CHIP program, as well as the cost per case adjustment. That's a slight decrease. Those are in tobacco tax revenues since the CHIP program has no general fund money. Then the rest of these next several ones, the increase in the OUS pharmacy contract, the Union Baker School District, the transfer forecasting, well, those two at least are adjustments in pass-through amounts that these entities pass through in order to get a Medicaid match.
Senator Duncan.
We were curious about the Union Baker School District. I can't remember that.
What is that?
The school districts pass through monies that they extend that might be Medicaid, well, that are, not might be, that are eligible for Medicaid match, and they send that money to OMAP, and then OMAP gets the Medicaid match and sends the whole thing back.
Now, may I ask you a question?
Okay.
Why specifically Union Baker? I don't understand why.
They have a contract with OMAP
to do
that.
Do they do it with others?
I think there are, what, four or five school districts.
School districts, and they're the...
Yeah. That do that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Follow up on this. Is this the special ed children that are transported and then there's Medicaid money to fund that? I know they fund some of the districts too. That. What is this money actually going for?
First.
Surprising.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Hirsch Crawford, the Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. This is, as Ms. Archer said, a pass-through arrangement that we have with several school districts in the state, where a certain amount of the administrative cost in each of these school districts is attributable to things that are chargeable to Medicaid administration, like helping outreach for OHP services, helping kids with access to services, those kinds of things. These are not direct payments for any services that are provided in the school districts, as Representative Bates referenced, in terms of kids that might be on IEP programs. And the school district bills us for a portion of their administrative expense that is relatable to Medicaid. We turn around and pay that claim to the school district, and then the school district refunds to us the state general fund cost of paying that claim, and so they net the federal piece, which is at a 50% match rate, and that's what this is with Union.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Hartung.
Hirsch, are each one of our 198 school districts eligible to do what you have just explained to me that three or four are doing?
Madam Chair, Senator Hartung, they are. At this point, we are doing it with Lynn Benton Lincoln, Union, Deschutes, Marion Polk, any others? I think that's it at this point.
Thank you.
The next adjustment is transfer forecasting position to the director's office. As reflected in the May rebalance, there is continued consolidation of administrative functions in the department, and one of those consolidations that has taken place in the last few months is that forecasting, caseload forecasting positions out in the divisions have been moved into the director's office, and this reflects that adjustment and the loss of one position, or actually the transfer of one position out of OMAP into the director's office. And then there is this next line item is the director's office prorate technical adjustment. Is simply that. It's simply a correction of something that should have been reflected in the budget. then there's a prorate to fund the forecasting positions. Once those positions go into the director's office, then they are, their costs are prorated out among the divisions, and this reflects that OMAP portion of that overall prorate. The next line item is the one that I told you was, I was going to mention, that relates to line 10 above, where there were miscellaneous revenue adjustments attached to some of the hospital payments and settlements. In reviewing the detail of those miscellaneous adjustments, it turns out that there was money added in the reshoot to increase ambulance rate payments, and whereas that was an issue that was discussed in the subcommittee, and the subcommittee was very interested in having those rates increased, that somehow found its way into the reshoot, but it's not a current service level issue. Mm-hmm. And so it, I have to take that out at this point, because that's not, that would not be appropriate as a current service level number. But knowing that the committee was interested in that, I was tempted to just leave it there, but I didn't.
Then that would be one of our ad back items.
And that would be an ad back item. I think the amount actually that has been identified is $630,000 that would be the amount that, that would be associated actually with that ad back, that this, this
$630,000.
And we can, I can get that exact number for you before we go to final work session, assuming that the committee is still interested in having that on an ad back.
Chair, yes.
I want.
Madam Chair, those are the are all of the adjustments to the current service level. The next page, I don't know if you want to take action on things as we go or if you want to go through the whole thing first.
Let's take them as we complete your
okay.
segment.
This question, Madam Chair?
Sure.
You're doing, this is OMAP total, and then you break it out into the various subcategories.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be appropriate to review all the subcategories before we make a motion on the...
Every line that's on the subcategories has been covered on the...
So your intention is just to do the front page?
Well, we could do that, although every line has been covered. There's nothing on the subsequent pages that has not been covered on the front page.
Okay.
Your page here
covers all these, I understand. Mm-hmm.
Unless you have a specific question on some of the...
The cost containment issues we're going to be addressing after we move the...
Well, this is only current service level adjustments that we've gone through. Yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay. So we can go back to page one. And the technical rate assessments.
Yeah, so the technical rate assessments equal $118,049 general fund, $1,200,042 other funds, and these are negative numbers, by the way, and a minus $948,839 general fund.
Administrator.
Yes, I guess I'd like to move the subtotal for the technical assessment reductions as just outlined by LFO, the OMAP budget.
Representative Schrader recommends we accept the technical rate assessment reductions as outlined by LFO. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So approved.
Do the
yes.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I'd like to move that we adopt the LFO subtotal reshoot adjustments, line 24, general fund $4,585,767. And tobacco tax, $6,403,244. Other funds, a reduction of $3,959,262. Federal funds, an addition of $8,158,987 for total funds of $15,188,736.01.
Representative Schrader recommends that we adopt the reshoot adjustments. And I won't go through all the list to be stated because you have it on record, with the inclusion of one FTE. Is there any objection? Hearing none. So
that produces a current service level of 874,000 42, supposed to be a comma, $470, general fund, $290,202,455, other funds, and $1,761,222,339 in federal funds for a current service level. That I assume is approved with, since everything's been approved.
Then now you're in the policy package.
Yeah. Okay. And then on the back of the front page, on page 2, are the adjustments to policy packages. There is a correction to be made in the 090 package. That's actually identified as reductions, but if you'll remember when we went through the, you probably won't remember, but I'll remind you that when we went through the budget, the 090 package is used at the final stages of getting the governor's recommended budget ready to take care of both reductions and other adjustments. And one of the things that was contained in that were drug management actions that were going to reduce the budget and by a certain amount. In the governor's budget, that was reduced by 2.4 million dollars, and that was an incorrect number. It should have been closer to $5 million, and this is the amount of the reduction that reflects a corrected savings from those actions. Then the
there was an error in the calculation.
No, there was a portion of the calculation left out. I think the governor's printed budget included the change included the copay element, but did not included the reduction in percentage compared to average wholesale price, the reduction from 89% to 87%, but did not include the reduction that related to the reduction in dispensing fees.
Okay. Representative Schrader.
Just to make sure I understand, there were three different elements that the governor did, I thought, to help manage some of the drug costs. One was the pharmacy rate change, one was the copay, and one was the management of the antidepressants. Which one are we referring to?
This refers to the pharmacy.
Okay.
The change in the rate of pay to the pharmacies, and that was understated in terms of the amount of savings that come from that action.
I'm sure is that the may I ask a question?
Is that
the prescriptions that are given to extended care facilities, nursing homes, or the part that goes just to the outpatient services?
It's my understanding it's both.
Hirsch?
No.
Madam Chair, this is the proposal that deals with the changing reimbursement to pharmacies, where the dispensing fee would go from the current $3.91 the current range is $3.91 to $4.28, and it would go to $3.50 for retail and $3.80 for pharmacies that serve institutional patients, and the dispensing fee would drop from, I mean, the cost of goods would drop from 89% to 87%. The problem with the original pricing was two. One is that we had not included savings in the original pricing from the change in the dispensing fee. And the second problem was that we have about $80 million in drug cost in the non-health plan portion of our budget, and we had not included that $80 million as subject to this price reduction as well. And so we've corrected both of those things, and that results in an additional savings of $2.5 million that is shown here.
How many institutional providers are there?
40. Madam Chair, I don't have the answer to that off the top of my head. I can get it for you. The way we actually calculate that is the highest dispensing fee right now, which is $4.28. is paid to those pharmacies which serve people in nursing homes. They dispense drugs in a different way in what's called a unit dose format, and it's more expensive, and that's why we pay the higher dispensing fee. And so the savings is based on the billings that we get against that highest dispensing fee, but I can get the number of pharmacies that are currently billing that.
And so the savings that you're talking about, the $5 million, actually is not a savings to those who are dispensing, but a savings to the budget. Madam
Chair, it is a reduction in reimbursement to pharmacies and a savings to our budget as a result of that reimbursement reduction.
Senator Yee.
I have received a lot of letters opposing the reduction in reimbursement service fees. I don't think we should reduce the service fees. On top of it, they do delivery also. So I don't see why we should make savings at the expense of people who are providing services. We will lose services. We continue to reduce those fees. And the end result is our clients will suffer. Either they don't get delivery or they get reduced services. Those pharmacies may close their services. I don't think this is the right way to make savings.
Are you recommending that this is one of our head back items?
Or we not reduce the distribution, the reimbursement in service fees?
Madam Chair, you're correct in the sense that since this is already in the governor's budget, the assumption of these reductions, that in order to not reduce fees, you would need to add that to an add-back list, since both the governor and the co-chairs assume in their planning the reduction. So the question would then be, if the subcommittee wants to add that to the add back list, do they want to do that for institutional services only or regular visits to the pharmacy?
For both. We should not reduce services, reimbursement fees.
Administrator.
I look forward to the discussion, but this is a budget that has huge cost increases in it, and in the drug budget in particular. So I think as we discuss some of the cost containment strategies and the minimal amount of savings we're getting out of those, we'll have to look very hard at ways to control the cost and utilization of pharmaceuticals in Oregon Health Plan, or we will be bankrupt next session. So while I understand the sentiment that the senator is speaking to, I worry about the implications long term for the state budget. So we have to be pretty thoughtful on this whole issue.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Representative Schrader is correct, of course. The real cost that's driving the cost of prescriptions, drugs up, though, is not the people dispensing the drugs. Mm-hmm. It's the cost of the drugs themselves.
Yes.
And I've received, as Senator Yee has, a tremendous amount of information on this. The pharmacists that are supplying drugs institutions, I think there's about 33 of them in the state, but I could be wrong on that number. It's the number that sticks in my mind. They have to be available 24 hours a day to do it, and they do it in unit dosing, so there's less errors in the nursing homes, and that's a good way to go. They don't dispense from nursing homes anymore. We did a look at what it costs other states to do this, and the reductions I thought were somewhat in line with other states, but yet at the same time, we heard a lot from pharmacists who I think are reliable people, this would really hurt their programs. I am at a quandary right now on which way to go on this particular package. I've heard in both sides, and it's not clear in my mind whether we're really putting these programs in danger by cutting the dispensing fees or not.
I, too, have heard from a member, and I think in addition, you know, we have a situation where if you look at, for example, the institutional, and I believe there's only about five or six of them, but that serve our institutions, and are we running the risk of them not being able to serve? And so it is a service issue that I do believe we need to take some look at a little further. Mm-hmm. So we'll put this on our list.
Okay, so I put institutional department.
Well, there's retail, there's both, there's retail and institutional.
Okay.
And I don't really know where the truth falls.
There are differing opinions that supposedly this reduces the rate to the rate paid by private insurers, but.
It's a classic case of shooting the messenger.
Yeah.
They're just passing through.
Anyway, I'll put that on the restoration.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Peggy, what is the total amount for restoring the fees for both institution and retail?
I'll have to add that. I'll have to get that precise number. I don't have it right in front of me.
It's not 2.4 million.
No, it would be closer to 5 million.
Oh, 5 million.
The next adjustment, if you're ready.
Yes.
The next adjustment is simply they have the policy package in the administration budget for OMAP has 16 positions, requests 16 positions in it. These are positions that for the most part are now existing as double-filled and temporaries to address the workload issues that are related with the increase in fee-for-service and relation to managed care. Under fee-for-service, OMAP has to make and process the payments themselves, whereas under managed care, of course, that's handled by the contracted caregiver. This simply reduces the PERS rate for those positions in that budget. The next line item reduces the personal services budget by one position in that package and a half an FTE for a position that seemed to be necessary. It was related to personnel issues associated with additional positions, and that's a director's office function that should be covered as a routine matter with the director's office handling personnel for the rest of the agency. The next reduction is a sizable reduction in the services and supplies that were in that budget. I think it cuts them down close to about half of the services supplies that were asked, not quite half, but certainly more than a third, in areas that seem to be not necessary additions in services and supplies. That was primarily cutting down on the in-state travel, cutting back on the purchase of equipment for the positions, cutting back on the purchase of rental space for the positions, eliminating any dues and subscriptions associated with the positions, and severely reducing what might appear to be sort of formula-driven additions related to positions that really didn't appear to be necessary. The next reduction is 1% of the co-chair's suggestion that 1% of services and supplies be reduced, and that's from the entire administrative budget. I did not, the instructions from the co-chairs were not to include special payments in that, and the reason this is such a small number on such a huge budget is that almost all of the vast majority of OMAP's budget is one line item budgeting, and that's special payments, because all of the health plan, Medicaid program, the CHIP program, and the non-health plan medical programs are all special payments that go out to providers. So those were not reduced. And then the next one is their 1% reduction in their out-of-state travel budget, which is a relatively small budget considering the size of the agency, so it doesn't produce a lot of savings.
Representative Schrader.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the policy package and other adjustments, correcting package 090, at least for now, PERS rate reduction in package 401, reducing package 401 personal services, reducing package 401 services and supplies, co-chairs 1% of services supplies, 1% out-of-state travel reduction for total or subtotal of package and other adjustments of a reduction of $2,662,532 million general fund, a reduction of $8,764 tobacco tax,
reduction of $26, other funds, reduction of $3,713,743 of federal funds, for a total of a reduction of $6,385,065.5 FTE.
Representative Schrader moves that we accept policy packages and other adjustments subtotaling $2,666,532 general fund, $8,764 tobacco funds, $5,159,330 other funds, and $3,496,405 federal funds, for a total of $6,536,741 total funds, two FTEs. Is there any objection?
Well,
any discussion?
Madam Chair, with the exception, Texture 090, the drug managed savings, will be listed on the end.
Yes. The amount that we had, the issue that we had
the total amount.
The total amount.
Is that, is this package you're suggesting include the drug savings?
Want me to discuss that at all?
We discussed the package 090. Is included in the adjustments. We will make a recommendation to the co-chairs respecting the add back of the drug management saving, specifically as it deals with the dispensing issue. Okay. Is there any objection? Hearing none. Approved.
And Madam Chair, there are several outstanding issues here. One is that, as the subcommittee knows, there has been a prescription drug cost containment work group that has been meeting regularly to look at a potential prescription drug cost containment measures. And I've attached a list to look at that for the committee to go down and see whether you concur with items that are listed there. One of the things I should point out, you'll see on the first page of that list, that's on page 7, the total comes to $12.5 million with the items that are in bold listed above. That's about $1.5 million short of what is assumed in savings in the both the governor's and the co-chair's plans. So I have a ways to go to come up with some additional savings. But if you would like, Madam Chair, I'll just go down these.
Please.
Madam Chair?
Representative Bates?
I was not a part of this work group. In fact, I was unaware of it. And I know about some of this information. Do we want to discuss it at this level, or do you want to just...
Peggy's going to go through the list of items on here.
During the hearings, the issue was brought up of whether the governor's co-payment that was in part of his drug cost container, drug management package, he had proposed a $1 for generic, $2 for brand name co-pay for prescription drugs. The agency was asked to price out what that would be if the co-pay were increased to $2 and $3 respectively. And that it came back with the information that that would generate an additional $1.6 million beyond the $2.3 that's in the governor's budget already. The prescription drug cost containment work group asked for several more iterations, and they asked for a $2 and $4, and that creates $2.3 million, not in addition to the $1.6, but $2.3 in addition to the governor's savings. And they also ask for a $1 for generic, $5 for brand name drug voluntary copay, and that would save $2.5 million beyond what, in addition to what was in the governor's budget. For the time being,
I'm sorry, can I ask a question? Could Representative Carlson, could someone explain the concept of voluntary as it relates to copay?
Well, it's just that. It is not mandatory. Mm-hmm. Neither the proposals from by the governor or by the work group that looked at the copay issue, it is to encourage the person to have some ownership. I think we discussed this last session in mm-hmm. the staff person to the committee that we just through this committee about the copay issue.
Specifically, the reason is that Medicaid does not allow mandatory. A mandatory copay, although one could probably seek a waiver for that, but the chances are very slim of getting a waiver, but that's something that could be considered at another time. But right now, the work group decided to go with the voluntary because that complies with current Medicaid.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question?
I just wanted to know if in the implementation of it, would the client be informed that the copay is voluntary, or would they be asked for a copay, and then if they weren't able to pay it, then it would be waived? I'm just trying to see how, think through how that would work.
The pharmacy, and then you can tell me, pharmacies cannot, under the Medicaid rules, cannot not give them the prescription if they don't pay.
Madam Chair.
What's your take?
Yeah, was a pharmacist, was a retail pharmacist involved in the work group?
Yes.
Yes, that's the reason that I pointed out early on that not everything that's on this list was concurred with unanimously. We didn't vote, but these were the ideas that were discussed.
And what was the position of the pharmacist on that work group?
Obviously, the pharmacist on the group was not in favor of this item for a couple of reasons, but the main reason is that the copay is not only voluntary, but if the person does not pay, it is the pharmacist who suffers the loss.
That's
so the reimbursement rate assumes that the copay will be paid.
So we're looking at a situation potentially where we're cutting the fee they get for filling the prescription, and with this kind of position in there, this would lower their cost or lower their return even further. Is that correct?
That's right.
Thank you.
The subcommittee was interested in pursuing, as I pointed out, some higher copays. I highlighted the $2 and $3 one for a couple of reasons. One, because they are amounts that are currently within Medicaid guidelines, which allow copays up to $3 and wouldn't necessarily require, I'm not saying they wouldn't require a waiver. I'm not sure about that, but it would be, if they were a revised plan change, it would require, but not, but it's within current Medicaid guidelines. The other was simply the reason that Representative Bates was mentioning, if you don't pay a $5 copay, that is a lot more of a loss to a pharmacy than if you don't pay a $3 copay. I mean, pharmacists may not figure that that's a much of a deal, but it seemed to mitigate that. And particularly because there are issues, I would think, with severely ill people who take multiple medications that there may not be a generic, and they may be the very people who are unable to work and have the least amount of money for a copay. But those are simply policy issues that surround this. So I very arbitrarily highlighted the 1.6. The committee could go to either of the others if they wished. But $1 and $2 are currently assumed in the governor's budget. So if you went below that, then there would need to be an add back. Moving on down the list, there was a lot of discussion. I left this on the list even though we determined that it wasn't going to generate money, but since I was short of the $14 million, I was willing to leave anything on the list. The fee-for-service optional mail order for chronic medications was something that we discussed, at length during the committee, but as we've, during the work group, excuse me, meetings, as it came out, this was not now a very feasible suggestion, but it, we determined that if you did at least encourage people and inform them of the availability of mail order, that there could be some increase in mail order usage and that there potentially could be some savings. Again, the pharmacists in the organization disagreed that there was savings in mail order, and that's a, that is a disagreement, I presume, among pharmacists, and among providers, since many providers encourage mail order, they must think that it saves money. So I don't know the answer to that question, but I left the $100,000 on the savings because this is a sort of simply an action of informing people that mail order is an option and may in fact be a convenience to people that haven't thought of that. I think that the agency currently has a contract with Fred Meyer for its mail order delivery, and I believe they said there are 44 people that take advantage of it out of all the fee for service people. The next line item is a lock-in of pharmacy that would allow better control over the drug utilization review and dispensing of drugs, and that would save about $1 million. This the way that would be done, as I understand, it doesn't require a bill, although there are bills out there that create that policy. The agency has the ability to do that without a bill, and the assumption is that they would do that with many of the provisions that are in, I believe it's 3311, or I'm not sure whether that's the appropriate bill, I think it is. In any event, those provisions provide for emergency situations where a person can get their prescription drugs in emergencies at something other than their designated pharmacy, and also for the sharing of information among pharmacies if somebody does go to a different pharmacy. The next one is a suggestion that there be a diagnosis requirement on code on prescriptions for selected drug classes, and OMAP estimates that that would generate $1.3 million in savings.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Did the OMA or the Medical Association give you any opinion on this? Were they at the meetings?
They were at the meeting. There's something in this for everybody to like or dislike.
I would tell you that I don't know what the OMA told you about this requirement, but I was about to guess that if we go forward with it, that there will be a disenrollment by physicians. They're already seeing these patients basically at cost. In other words, they don't get paid for seeing these patients. To put an extra requirement on them that every time they write a prescription, they have to go look up a diagnosis code, a 5-digit code, and put on a prescription is something I think might be hotly debated and resisted. I just don't think it's something that's going to happen. Then you've got to go through those prescriptions, decide which ones are above or below the line, decide which one the pharmacist can get reimbursed for or not get reimbursed for, and then tell the patient, this is below the line, we're not reimbursing it today, and at which point we may be forced to give the prescription anyway under Medicaid law. I just don't see this as a viable suggestion. I'm sorry.
Just pointing out that in this whole work group, to discussing this issue on where to find potential cost containment, drug cost savings, there's something to like and dislike by every group that's involved in this issue.
Mm-hmm. Just want to get on the record, Madam Chair.
So I just want to get on the record to say that there's likes and dislikes all over the place.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
There's likes and dislikes, but I'm more interested in the size of the club. Disenrollment by physicians could be a major problem for the health plan, so I'm just really concerned about that. I mean, we're already losing them all over the place.
Just putting up, Madam Chair, is doing a more little bear.
Representative Bates, and I'm not going to go into this, but
let's,
I think that
let's
move on. Peggy is giving the things that came out of a work group, and I don't think that there's, you know, the pill is a bitter pill.
Okay.
Peggy.
No pun intended.
No pun intended.
this is true, of course, as I mentioned earlier with OMAP's budget, when you've got almost $3 billion, most of which goes out to pay directly to pay providers, anytime you cut that, some person is affected. And so it's almost impossible to reduce costs without affecting either the client or the provider. The next thing on the list is not highlighted because there was very little discussion of that, and that's the governor's proposal for a formulary, which was not in his budget, by the way. The next thing on the list is the what's called the Muse study. As some of you may know, there was a contractor, Don Muse, who OMAP contracted with to analyze its Medicaid data and see if there were drug management actions that could be realized that would generate savings. That took place in a very rapid way at the end once the contract was affected. And Mr. Muse came back and proposed, made some proposals and projections of savings. Those were reviewed for about a week, and there were some differences in assumptions between OMAP and Mr. Muse, and although I must say that they worked very cooperatively together, I attended many of their, or several of their sessions together, and there was not acrimonious disagreement on anything. I've reviewed, and then Mr. Muse came back to give his counter views, and then I met with Mr. Muse and the department after that, and what I did here is show you some of the issues. After Mr. Muse came back the second time, there were some errors in his spreadsheets when he was here. I believe it was last Thursday or Friday. And we got back to him. He resubmitted some of those spreadsheets that same day, or the next day, I guess it was. And anyway, what I've done is come down on a conservative side. Primarily the difference between Mr. Muse's assumptions and the agencies was on the rapidity with which you could achieve full savings in some of the actions. His assumed that you could have almost instant savings. Ours, OMAP's, and I concur with them, assume that they're because of the state's contracting requirements that you can't immediately start realizing drug management savings, and particularly savings that reflect changes in behavior of people. So what I've done is shown you for each of the actions. One of his actions was already assumed in the actuary's pricing of capitation rates, so we eliminated that. Prior authorization for drugs in of 20 or more within a 6-month period produced $4.1 million in general fund savings. Mr. Muse on the second round was asked to target 15 or more in order to potentially generate additional savings, and if you did that, it would generate another $2.3 million. I talked about this with him afterwards because those people that were in his original presentation, when we asked him why he selected 20 instead of some other number, he said that that was an arbitrary number, but he felt that it was a number that was reasonable in that it would identify enough people that they could begin the process of the disease management without and gain some experience before they then would reduce it, because that was the question: why do 20? Why not do 9 or 10 or some other number? The statement at the time was that he felt that it was a good thing to start at a number, gain some expertise, and then move down as you go. He was asked to provide the 15, and it was the work group that suggested that we ask him to provide what the savings would be if he went down to 15. I talked with him after he delivered that and asked him how he felt about the 15. He said that it was his opinion that the 20 would be better. Starting higher is better, but if you have to come up with the savings for budgetary reasons, you could go to 15. So I put in the 20 and say the same thing to you. If you have to come up with the savings, it is riskier, but there's an extra $2.3 million there.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest show disease management, disease state management, the difference between the 900,000 that I show here and Mr. Muse's assumptions would add another 400,000 is, again, an assumption about a rate of saving, a percentage of savings that you can get, and his percentage assumes an earlier capture of savings. The savings in the out years, they have no disagreement on in terms of the percentage of savings that would be achieved in the second and third years. It's only in the first year that there is an assumption on OMAP's part of a more phased in savings as opposed to almost immediate. And the same is true with the case management of high cost cases. That's the difference in the 400,000 versus the extra 200,000. What I would ultimately recommend on the Muse study is that you take the $5.4 million here in savings and that you take another $2.9 million, which would be the more optimistic view that Mr. Muse has, and reserve that $2.9 million in the emergency fund. Because as we pointed out and discussed during the hearings, we were looking for money that we could appropriate to the emergency fund for a couple of reasons, primarily for the risk that's associated with the no flexibility caseload, but there is also risk associated with not achieving the savings in these management actions as well. And so that ultimately would be my recommendation on the with respect to the Muse study.
With all due respect, this is not the time for me to debate this with Peggy or anybody else, and I won't. I would tell you that there are strong and serious concerns about whether the Muse study really represents reality or not, and what the effect would be on physicians taking part in the plan. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, I concur, but I think that there is a strong interest in accepting that. And I have talked with I think almost all of the states that Mr. Muse has done business with, and the reviews are mixed in terms of the value.
And there are some states today that actually drove costs up, so we won't debate that today.
Yeah. The next item on the list is the establishment of a state maximum acquisition cost, and that was discussed, the benefits of that. We compared, we looked closely at the state of Washington, and based on an analysis of the administrative costs that are associated with that, the work group felt that that was the way to go, and that would be a $1.7 million of savings. And then the last item was to establish a 15-day maximum for initial prescriptions for chronic drugs, and that came out to a $1.4 million savings. That did not imply that you could not have a refill. It's just that the initial prescription would be for 15 days, and therefore there would be presumably some savings from non-utilization of that other 19 days, I suppose, that would have been on a typical prescription. So those are the ideas that the work group came up with. The $12.5 million excludes the formulary, and it is based, again, on the copay of $2 and $3 rather than the $1 and $2 that's in the governor's budget. Madam Chair, we can either vote on these now or hold these as outstanding issues. Okay. The back of the page again shows other reduction or cost containment actions, all of which again managed to hit somebody someplace. The first one is implement a $5 outpatient copay. This was suggested during the hearings, and OMAP priced that. the savings would be $2.5 million if you assumed that the Medicaid payment to the provider was going to be assuming this copay, regardless of whether the provider was able to collect it or not. In essence, the same issue that we discussed with the prescription drug copay. The savings would be $1.4 million if you assumed that the copay would be deducted from the Medicaid payment only if the provider was able to collect it. So that is another option to consider for reduction.
Madam Chair.
Congressman Bates.
This is what I would strongly support, believe it or not. This actually, the real benefit of this is not the $5 or whatever you set it at. It's overutilization you can get to with this. And I think that's an important issue to look at. Once a prescription has been written, it's usually assumed, and rightly so, I believe, that prescription needs to be filled. There is some overutilization of physicians and physician services, and I think this might be a worthwhile tool to help hold down costs.
Thank you.
The next item would be to change the coverage date to the first of the month after eligibility is determined. This would be for new eligibles in the expansion group only, and this follows the concepts that have been discussed surrounding the request for a waiver that would expand services to people up to 200% of the poverty level. In the discussions of House Bill 2519, which is not before you now, but that is the waiver bill, there is a lot of discussion around creating a waiver that would provide two benefit levels, something that presumably looks like the current benefit level or something similar for, it doesn't say that actually in that bill, it just says OHP plus for the, what one would call the traditional eligibles, and then OHP standard, which would be a basic benefit plan for new eligibles, those that are newly eligible because of the health plan, and also the expansion group that would be in the waiver, which is that group of people between 100 and 200% of the poverty level. There is discussion, or has been a lot of discussion, about making that basic benefit plan tie in with private insurance or look like private insurance. And one of the components of private insurance is that generally when a person applies, they are determined to be eligible, and then their coverage begins in the next month after they're determined to be eligible. This would fit that pattern, and there would be some cost shifting if there were a person that came in and you had the circumstance where they're signed up in the hospital. There's no doubt that there would be some cost shifting there. On the other hand, there are two other sides to that story. One is that there has been a lot of testimony that there is not enough utilization of the plan by the new eligibles group for preventative services, and that there is an enticement or a motivation to go into an emergency situation, have your care taken care of, and then once you're taken care of, there isn't necessarily any need to be in the plan anymore, or perceived need. And therefore, because there are premiums and potentially copays. And so this would perhaps encourage people to sign up and participate in the plan as a matter of conscious choice at good preventative health. The other issue is that even though there would be some cost shifting for anybody that was cared for during that period between when they applied and when they were determined eligible, on the other side of that coin, by being able to finance the expansion of the service to people from 100 to 200% of the poverty level, you are capturing 50 to 60,000 people for whom there is presumably no reimbursement at all at this point. So it's sort of a trade-off issue if we're helping finance the expansion. obviously that isn't going to be popular with every provider. The other is to consider when we get down the line and if there is a waiver bill considered. Currently, the Health Services Commission, as we learned in our hearings, is working on a basic benefit plan that is about 78% of the current value of the current costs of the plan. And that, in fact, is cost neutral, as has been announced in 0103, but it is not cost neutral in 0305. It has a roll-up cost of $26 million general fund dollars. In 0305, if when the waiver bill is considered, there is a discussion about whether that ought to be cost neutral, then you would, in order to do that, you would create a basic benefit plan that would be a combination, or could be a combination of benefit plan, copays, premiums. A variety of things that would generate $9.2 million of savings in the current biennium, but would not cause any roll-up for the expansion group up to 200% of the poverty level in 0305. So it would, in effect, this is what it would cost to truly make the waiver, as it has been described, cost neutral. Those are things that are out there for consideration in the next few days.
Senator Yee.
Madam Chair, well, I think the committee, as well as a lot of people, are concerned that the managed care providers, the large managed care providers, are leaving the health care plan. Because of financial losses and inability to negotiate contracts with hospitals and physicians. I understand from Hirsch Crawford that there may be community care providers coming in, but we need to hear the progress of these enrollment providers' participation, and with the lack of increase in cost of living increase for fee-for-service, I think a lot of physicians may not contract with the Oregon Health Plan, and that means in the rural areas when they have no health care providers and lack of fee-for-service provision, the rural area will really have no access to the Oregon Health Plan. So I believe that we need to have interim policy and fiscal management oversight of the Oregon Health Plan, and includes legislators who are familiar with these issues and also on emergency board that can provide oversight and watch the progress. So make sure that the system is stable and effective. So I think Chair also wishes to yep. do an interim committee, and I think it's very much needed, not just to see how they are coming along, but to see the implementation of MMIS and to hear the update on waivers. So I think this is a much needed interim committee.
I would concur, and we haven't, Peggy hasn't discussed the other outstanding issues that are there. You and I both agree that, you know, I believe that there is a need for an interim oversight committee that deals with some of the budgetary issues as you described. And, you know, there's also the, you know, we still have to deal with the issue of the cost savings, and we still have to deal with whether the waiver, House Bill 2519, whether it has movement through this building, it's still standing out there someplace, so we haven't really began to address that one. And then Representative Hill wanted to look further at exploring savings in the interim and looking at some of the dispensing costs and some of those and delivery prescription drugs issues. you know, unfortunately, we come into this building and we're here a short period of time. The issues surrounding the Oregon Health Plan are very comprehensive and not an issue that you can set in one sitting or two settings, begin to come up with some solutions. It's evolving over time, and as I said earlier, just in the work group that we had looking at drug cost containment, there's something to like or dislike by everyone that was in that group to discuss this issue. And the administration was with us, first was with us in this group. We tried to put together individuals who all were stakeholders to discuss these issues, recognizing that we do have a serious problem in Oregon and that we do need to address the issues, not only as it relates to the physicians, the hospitals, the company, the pharmaceuticals, those who dispense. So by the time you get to looking, and then the person who needs it, you know, I think sometimes we talk about all these other pieces and we forget about the person who needs the service that we're sitting up here talking about. And so it's going to be one that we're not going to get there in a hurry, and I concur that we do need an interim group to work on some of these issues that we've raised during the session. Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, I don't think I could have spoken better than Senator V, and you have already spoken. This is a time of change for the Oregon Health Plan, and if we're going to maintain it, we're going to have to make some tough decisions, and I agree with that. And we won't make them here in the next day or two. We'll get enough done to keep it rolling, I expect. You also probably are aware that 2519 is being revamped as we speak. Representative Cruz and I and the governor's group are working on that and coming out with a more fleshed-out program to look at the waivers. Whether we get the waivers or not is still a question, and whether that ever changes is a question, too. The legislators are going to have to be ready to move on that potentially before the next session if the waivers come down. Many of the roles are changing for the Health Service Commission for people who are delivering the plan. We are seeing some improvement in care groups being formed with physicians primarily running them to work the Oregon Health Plan, but that's not going to resolve the problem for smaller areas, rural areas, as far as fee-for-service is concerned. We've got a long ways to go, a lot of problems to resolve, and I think work group interim is the appropriate way to tackle this very difficult problem.
Maybe you can meet on every 2 months basis, kind of coincide with the emergency board meetings, so that some recommendations can be made to emergency board if they meet every 8 weeks. I think emergency board meets about every 8 weeks.
It meets, it ranges from 8 to 11 weeks between meetings, and you know, that can, Madam Chair, that can be worked out. One of the problems that we have that's not necessarily unresolvable, but everybody tries to meet around the emergency board. The audit committee meets around the emergency board. The Joint Legislative Information Management Technology Committee meets around the emergency board. And the same office staffs those three committees. And so if we have another committee, and the Legislative Fiscal Office staff is preparing for the Emergency Board, the Audit Committee, the JLCIMT, and the OMAP work group, then we have sometimes a problem of clumping work issues. But it does save money in terms of travel for legislators, that's sure. So I'm sure that...
You mean if you get us all here in the building over a 1 or 2 day period of time?
Madam Chair, shall I go on down?
Yes.
I had the next item was to address the budget notes that I had noted that the committee wanted from reviewing my notes of the hearings. And Senator Yee had asked specifically that the agency come back and report on its strategy for achieving increase in managed care and trying to work that percentage back up to its goal. That, of course, if you do have an interim group, it would be an ideal place for them to report on that strategy.
Just for committee members' information, see, I didn't know exactly what is the goal. So Ms. Archer said it's 82%?
I believe it's 82, or, yeah.
And what is it now?
I think it's 77. Low 70s now. Well, okay. Going down. Mm-hmm. It has been, I think, as high as 89%. The reason that I think that even though there is an end, on down a few lines, I talk about the a budget note for the some interim committee or task force, I think that having a separate note that identifies this desire takes care of the fact that if that task force doesn't get appointed, at least they would be coming back to the emergency board or some appropriate group with that report. The next suggested budget note, and I haven't drafted these yet, but I will before get to the thing, but I want you to at least approve the topic so that you're interested in the budget note. Representative Hill, who was a primary interested person in our work group with respect to increasing the use of mail order for the delivery of prescription drugs, would like to have a budget note that encourages the agency to go ahead and review alternatives for maximizing cost reductions with respect to the delivery of prescription drugs. And so I will draft such a note if the committee concurs. The next one is a suggestion that, as we've discussed, was raised by the chair and Senator Yee, and that there be some interim oversight committee or task force. This issue first came up in testimony on the public testimony day when some of the providers suggested that there be a group that could deal with some of the provider issues between OMAP and the providers, and this oversight task force might also serve that purpose, and to review and I won't say adjudicate, but review and make recommendations concerning issues that are of concern to providers as they come forward and are reported. So those are three budget notes that I know of that the committee has expressed interest in.
So, Peggy, can you say that again, which three budget notes?
The three that are listed here.
You have listed.
There's a budget note about achieving. Right here.
The top three?
No, this budget note. The strategy
mm-hmm.
for achieving managed care enrollment goals, exploring ways to maximize savings in dispensing and delivery of prescription drugs, and interim oversight committee or task force.
Okay.
And by the way, the budget note about an interim committee or oversight is not a budget note that would create this committee, because we don't have the ability to do that by budget note. It would be a budget note that would recommend to the legislative leadership that they establish such an interim work group or task force.
And then we have the note that Weston wants to be on that.
Yeah. And then there, if you have other budget notes, I'm not encouraging budget notes, but they ought to be seen before we get to the final work session. Let me put it that way.
If you get them to me.
But again, budget notes don't replace legislation. They need to reflect something related to the costs in the budget. Then we also have upcoming as outstanding issues a bevy of related legislation that is in Ways and Means or not in Ways and Means, but one of those is, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the number of the bill that is the bill that has the continuation of the 10-cent tobacco surcharge. That bill, I believe, is now in rules. And that bill, if it were not to pass, we would need to reduce the budget by over $35 million. So that is out there someplace. And then there is, of course, the waiver bill and the reorganization bill, and then half a dozen bills that have to do with prescription drugs that we will need to, with the chair, sift over and see where there are crossovers and duplications, and see also what is necessary in terms of needed legislation or desired legislation, even if it's not needed.
So if you thought that you had completed your task, just to give you a heads up, it's just beginning.
The last thing I wanted to comment on is again, I will be judging from the reaction today. I can see that we're probably more than $1.5 million short of the $14 million goal for prescription drug health plan savings that is assumed in both the co-chairs and the governor's budget. Also, it was a concern of the committee and certainly of staff that I be able to identify some source of revenue to appropriate to the emergency fund as a contingency related to caseload and other issues. And so I will continue to look for that source of money.
We know that you have a very, very, very good eye. Yes, Senator Shields. Senator Shields.
Yes, Senator Hartung and I were just talking. We've used this word add back a lot in the last couple weeks of our work sessions. Is it possible to get a list of all of the add backs that have been?
I have requested, in fact, I did that yesterday to get a list, and so we're working on those issues.
I realize it's dynamic and gets added to every day and so on, but it would be helpful to kind of have a scorecard.
Representative Schrader.
I apologize for having to step out for a little bit, but I guess I would also remind the committee, and it's a good committee. I mean, this is a committee that's been very, very thoughtful, and to that extent, we have to also find some savings. We do not keep this building for another few weeks as it is, and if we do not find, I think Peggy's being charitable, we need to find $20 million total savings in this budget to get out of town. So to the extent you want to have add-backs, I really feel at this point in time when I look at the big picture, unless we're able to contain some of the costs in some fashion, maybe not burdening just one provider group, but we need to find some ability to get a handle on these or we will not be leaving for probably a month or two.
And
just a challenge. But we can do that. I think this is a big
Well, Representative Schrader gave us a reality check. He is correct. And it's more than just add back, quote unquote, but the challenge is to find the savings, and it's not just in this budget, but other budgets that we're reviewing. And I think one also has to remember when we're going through the budget process, we tend to think about the here and now. We do have the challenge of what we do this session affects what's coming down the line the next session. So just to keep those thoughts in mind as we do our deliberation. And Peggy, if you have any other thoughts before I adjourn.
The only is that I've got two things on the add back list, speaking of that, and that's the ambulance and the drugs.
Okay.
And, Madam Chair, can we have a breakdown when it comes to drugs, a breakdown for retail and for...
With that, we are adjourned.
What is it, 25?